Lisa F. Smith's memoir has been lauded as a darkly comic, honest portrayal of addiction within the high-pressure world of corporate law. Jennifer Bell, Anna David, and other notable authors praise Smith's ability to depict someone completely in control while being radically out of control. This raw account of high-functioning addiction resonates deeply with readers because it shatters the stereotype of what an addict looks like. Unlike many addiction memoirs that focus on dramatic, rock-bottom moments, Smith's story reveals how someone can maintain the appearance of success while spiraling internally. The book has become particularly significant for professional women who rarely see their experiences with addiction represented in literature. Smith's journey from prestigious law offices to psychiatric facilities offers a chilling, yet ultimately hopeful narrative that has made it a staple recommendation in recovery communities nationwide. On what seemed like an ordinary Monday morning in early spring, Lisa Smith made an extraordinary decision that would alter the course of her life. After 15 years of secret drinking and drug use, hiding vodka bottles in her designer handbags and sneaking bathroom breaks at work to maintain her buzz, she finally reached for her phone and called friends to help her enter detox. Jerry arrived first at her Upper East Side apartment, his suit slightly rumpled from rushing over from his law firm. Russell and Devin followed shortly after, all three taking precious time from their high-powered careers to support their friend in crisis. As they gathered in her meticulously decorated apartment, the group shared what would be their final drinks together, an expensive Bordeaux that Lisa had been saving for a special occasion. The scene was surreal, four successful professionals drinking wine at 9 a.m. while discussing rehabilitation facilities. Lisa's mind raced with fears about her future social life. Would she still be invited to the weekly dinner parties? Could she handle workplace happy hours sober? When the time came to leave, Lisa attempted to back out, making excuses about work deadlines and client meetings, but Devin, her closest friend of 20 years, firmly insisted she follow through, saying, "You won't survive another year like this." At Gracie Square Hospital, the stark contrast between Lisa's polished exterior life and her new reality became apparent. The facility's institutional green walls and fluorescent lighting seemed worlds away from her usual haunts of upscale restaurants and luxury boutiques. Brad, an intake counselor with kind eyes and a worn notebook, explained the serious nature of the facility, a locked psychiatric ward requiring a minimum 72-hour stay. The lack of privacy was emphasized by rooms without locks and mandatory group activities. Despite Devin's visible concern about leaving her friend in such a place and Lisa's own mounting panic, she forced herself to sign the admission papers with trembling hands. In the communal dining area, Lisa sat uncomfortably in her Armani blazer among 20 other patients in various states of withdrawal and recovery. Their curious stares made her acutely aware of how out of place she looked. The institutional breakfast, rubbery eggs and watered-down orange juice served on plastic trays, made her desperately crave her morning ritual of chilled Grey Goose. When Dr. Landry arrived for her evaluation, Lisa had rehearsed a story about temporary stress and occasional overindulgence, hoping to secure a quick discharge. Instead, she found herself breaking down and confessing the truth that she'd never admitted aloud. "I drink a lot. Every day. I start as soon as I wake up and I can't stop. Sometimes I drink hand sanitizer when I run out of alcohol." Overwhelmed with tears and increasingly severe withdrawal symptoms, trembling hands, cold sweats, and rising anxiety, she listened as Dr. Landry explained the dangerous reality of alcohol withdrawal and the possibility of seizures or death without proper medical supervision. Though dreading the days ahead, Lisa agreed to stay, realizing there was no going back. Her carefully constructed facade had crumbled, and everyone important in her life now knew her darkest secret. She had taken the first step toward survival, but her body and mind still craved that familiar comfort of an icy bottle in her shaking hand, even as she began to understand it might kill her. Lisa's relationship with substances began long before her first drink, rooted in early emotional coping mechanisms that would shape her future struggles. As an 8-year-old at summer camp, she experienced deep humiliation when an audience misunderstood her carefully practiced canoe maneuver as an accidental fall, The laughter that erupted from the crowd burned into her memory. After dramatically recounting the story to her sympathetic mother, Lisa immediately asked for double her normal ice cream portion, revealing an early pattern of using food for emotional relief. This moment marked one of the first clear instances where she consciously sought external comfort to soothe internal pain. Even at that young age, she understood her relationship with food was fundamentally different from other children's. While her peers could casually enjoy treats, Lisa developed secretive behaviors, sneaking extra portions at meals, hiding candy under her mattress, and hoarding snacks in her school backpack. Food became her private solution to every emotional challenge: anxiety before tests, loneliness during recess, or disappointment after gymnastics practice. She found that sweets just plain made me feel better in a way other children didn't seem to need or understand. A pivotal moment came during a routine pediatrician visit where Dr. Birnbaum, without empathy or understanding of the psychological implications, coldly warned, "If you don't stop eating, you're going to be as big as a house." This clinical assessment, delivered with shocking insensitivity, caused intense shame that would echo through her teenage years. Her mother's immediate reaction, angrily calling him an asshole and taking Lisa for comfort food at Burger King, inadvertently reinforced the pattern of using food as emotional medicine. Lisa's after-school routine became a ritualistic escape, watching TV with multiple bowls of ice cream, knowing it cemented her status as the pudgy kid, but finding those 90 minutes of sweetness the closest I ever came to happy. This daily practice became her first experience with addiction-like behavior, a scheduled, compulsive activity she couldn't imagine living without. Growing up in an upper-middle-class suburban home, Lisa observed her parents' sophisticated social drinking culture, noticing how adults transformed with alcohol, becoming more animated, affectionate, and uninhibited. Their home regularly hosted elaborate cocktail parties, where her father, wearing his prized custom Smitty bartender vest, meticulously crafted Manhattans and martinis for appreciative guests. This normalized alcohol as a social lubricant and mood enhancer. Her progression into alcohol use followed a dangerous trajectory. By age 8, she secretly sipped abandoned drinks at parties, savoring the burning sensation. By 10, she deliberately caught buzzes that made her feel happy, relaxed, and uninhibited for the first time. By 12, she was regularly drinking to silence the trash-talking mosquito of self-doubt in her head. By 13, she had cultivated friendships exclusively with drinking kids, and by 15, she was binge drinking and experimenting with marijuana on weekends. Despite maintaining perfect grades and getting accepted to Northwestern University, achievements that masked her growing dependency, by 18, she was a blackout drunk who could no longer control her consumption once she started. This pattern of using substances to manage emotions, first established with food and later transitioning to alcohol and drugs, would follow her into adulthood, creating a complex foundation for addiction that would take decades of therapy, support groups, and personal work to overcome. Lisa's story demolishes the stereotype of the disheveled, unemployed addict. Throughout her descent into addiction, she maintained a successful career as a corporate lawyer at a prestigious firm. Her colleagues saw her as competent, reliable, and perpetually cheerful, never suspecting she was drinking vodka from water bottles and snorting cocaine in bathroom stalls between meetings. After transferring to corporate finance, Lisa's anxiety skyrocketed. Despite feeling inadequate among Ivy League graduates, she attended Rutgers Law School, she excelled professionally while her personal life disintegrated. On business trips, she established a pattern: grueling document review during the day, avoiding dinner with colleagues to drink alone in her hotel room at night. In Florida, she extended her stay for a day of poolside drinking, shocked to discover she'd consumed 12 beers in one afternoon. Back in New York, her drinking escalated to nightly wine binges. Unlike her parents' ritualistic cocktail hour that provided comfort and connection, Lisa's solitary drinking felt shameful. She admitted to herself she was an alcoholic, but decided to become a really good alcoholic rather than quit. Despite maintaining appearances as a successful young lawyer with an enviable life, she increasingly spent nights alone, drinking until she cried herself unconscious. By 2003, cocaine had joined her morning routine, The stimulant allowed her to drink without looking drunk. She just looked happy. "You're always smiling," colleagues would say, never knowing the dark truth. Addiction kept raising the stakes. She needed a full bottle of wine to feel what one glass used to do, and her lies became more elaborate to cover bruises and missed events. She'd stopped contributing to her 401k, expecting to be dead by 40. When her brother's first child was born, she stayed home doing lines instead of rushing to the hospital, lying to her mother about needing to finish work. Perhaps most alarming was the day she left cocaine in an open cigarette pack on her office desk, a potentially career-ending mistake that sent her into panic during a partner meeting. When the meeting ended, she sprinted back to find her stash untouched, collapsing with relief, but unable to escape the reality of what she'd become. Addiction transformed Lisa's relationships into performances where she constantly hid her true self. With friends like Jessica, Russell, Devin, Jerry, and David, she maintained the facade of a successful young professional who simply enjoyed partying. When she blurted out, "I think I'm an alcoholic," at a sophisticated Tribeca party, they immediately dismissed the idea. David argued, "If you were an alcoholic, you'd be messing up at work." Jessica suggested she was just a heavy drinker. Though she could have offered convincing evidence of her addiction, she let them talk her out of it, deepening her isolation. Her romantic relationships suffered similarly. After a chance reconnection with Alan, she moved to Pittsburgh and married him, hoping a change of scenery might help her drinking problem. Her friends thought she was batshit crazy for leaving New York, but they didn't understand her desperation. Drinking alone nightly, seeing nothing ahead but office drudgery followed by alcohol-induced misery. Their wedding was a blur of champagne. 3 months into marriage in Pittsburgh, Lisa was miserable despite her perfect new life. She started drinking at noon on Saturdays and hid bottles behind cleaning supplies. While cooking dinner, she secretly gulped wine before serving Alan, who drank normally. As they ate watching TV, she'd think, "Be happy. Look how lucky you are," before slipping away to do dishes and fill her glass again. Later, after her marriage ended, Lisa met Mark, a student 10 years her junior who lived in her building. Despite her disheveled appearance, mascara-smeared eyes, bloated face, and tangled hair, he seemed oddly comfortable with her, even suggesting breakfast together after a night of drinking. Mark became a fixture in her apartment, unfazed by her drinking and drug use. When he eventually confronted her about her addiction and suggested rehab, she exploded in anger and threw him out. Yet he would later become a crucial support during her early recovery. The profound loneliness of addiction permeated all her relationships. As she put it, she felt like she was alone in a little boat floating far out on open water, the people on shore getting smaller and smaller. Lisa's life became meticulously organized around obtaining and consuming alcohol and cocaine. Her relationship with Henry, her primary cocaine dealer, was more reliable than most of her friendships. A half-Greek, half-Cuban business student, Henry delivered cocaine to her apartment for $250 an 8-ball, allowing her to work all night on client proposals while drinking heavily. Weekends passed in a blur of justified isolation, working from home while cycling between cocaine, alcohol, and cigarettes. She traveled a McDonald's arch-shaped path between her couch with laptop, kitchen for booze, and bedroom for drugs. Despite her slovenly state, she tried to mask the cigarette smell with candles and Lysol. Mornings became a nightmare of withdrawal symptoms, shaking, stomach sickness, and crushing depression. She averaged only 4 hours of sleep, her face pale and body thin from not eating. Somehow, she managed to get to work, downing Advil and industrial-sized cups of coffee. She still drew the line at morning drinking. That was for serious alcoholics, not high-functioning partiers like her. But that line eventually disappeared, too. By fall 2003, she'd crossed another boundary, going to work under the influence. Unable to wait until lunch, she'd drink before leaving her apartment, mixing oversized screwdrivers and doing lines of cocaine. Paranoia haunted her in public spaces, convinced everyone could smell alcohol on her or that drug-sniffing dogs would somehow detect her habit. The aftermath of her weekend binges was brutal. Her heart would beat irregularly, her head would pound, and the chirping birds outside her window at 4 a.m. filled her with hatred. Nothing unusual happened the weekend before she sought help. No accidents, no humiliations, no blackouts. Yet somehow on Monday morning, an epiphany burst like an aneurysm, leading her to make those calls and walk through the rehab doors. Lisa's 3 days in detox at Gracie Square Hospital marked her first consecutive days without alcohol since college. The experience was both terrifying and transformative. After her chest x-ray, she stood in line with about 8 other detox patients in the dimly lit basement, all wearing heavy lead aprons like a team of exhausted, wrecked knights waiting for a match. Nurse Jane informed her she'd be taking both Librium for alcohol withdrawal and Lexapro for depression. The tiny yellow Librium capsule didn't look powerful, but after taking it with the white Lexapro tablet, Lisa wondered if addressing her depression might make not drinking easier. The medication quickly took effect, making her dizzy and fuzzy-headed, but allowing her to fall into her first alcohol-free sleep in 10 years. During her stay, Dr. Landry visited her regularly, asking about her symptoms, the shakiness, nausea, and headache that were improving but still present. When questioned about what brought her to rehab, Lisa struggled to explain how she reached her breaking point that Monday morning when she simply couldn't function anymore. She confessed her daily physical struggles, the shaking, vomiting, and blood in her stool, and her emotional exhaustion with who she'd become. Dr. Landry explained alcoholism as a disease involving brain chemistry, often tied to underlying depression. When he suggested she might never drink again, requiring medication and a 12-step program for recovery, Lisa was devastated. The thought of life without alcohol, no happy hours, no social drinking, no relief from stress, seemed impossible. Though she nodded in agreement, inside she was screaming for vodka. By Friday morning, her Librium dosage was tapered in preparation for release. Dr. Landry expressed disappointment that she'd refused extended treatment, emphasizing that staying sober would be the most difficult thing you've ever done. Despite her fragile sobriety, Lisa agreed to outpatient treatment and daily meetings just to secure her release, though she was already planning to minimize her commitment. As she prepared to leave, she took a mental snapshot of the hospital, hoping the memory might deter future drinking. She acknowledged how wrong she'd been. She couldn't control her drinking alone, her alcoholic lifestyle wasn't just who I am, and she was now considering quitting entirely. Yet as she left, she felt vulnerable, no longer the confident corporate lawyer, but fragile, with the comforting thought of her bar stool at Kenny's already tempting her. Despite strong advice against returning to work too soon, Lisa felt she had no choice. At the office, she was confronted by the physical evidence of her addiction, paper piles and post-it notes everywhere, her desperate attempt to compensate for an unreliable memory. When her colleague Rick invited her for a smoke break, she maintained her story about stomach problems rather than revealing the truth about rehab. As they finished their cigarettes, Rick casually asked if she wanted to hit the bar after work, sending an electrical charge through her body. Her walk home became a gauntlet of temptation as she passed familiar drinking spots like Shades of Green and Pete's Tavern. Looking through Pete's window, she saw what looked like an aquarium of exotic fish gliding past each other. The craving felt dangerous as she thought how easy it would be to slide up to the bar for a quick glass of wine. She tried to convince herself those drinkers were chained to the bar while she was free, but that didn't work. The unbearable truth was that many people could have a drink or two and stop, an ability she wasn't born with. After a few weeks of sobriety, Lisa felt mentally and physically fantastic. Rested after sleep, energetic during the day, and beginning to feel good about herself. That's when the terror of relapse set in. She was told in group that she'd been riding a pink cloud, the happy glow that newly clean addicts float in after being released from hell. But what happens when the novelty wears off? Her friend Calvin from group knew about that all too well. Despite being insightful about his addiction, he'd relapsed repeatedly over 10 years. When Lisa asked why he kept using, he explained that he knew his latest relapse would happen when he agreed to meet his friend Bill on a Friday night. "If I don't want to pick up, I don't go out with Bill on Friday night. It's that simple," he told her. "Maybe you can hang out with your friends on weekend nights just drinking Diet Coke, but I can't." Lisa didn't think she could either. Calvin warned her that once you give sobriety a serious attempt, the joy of using is gone forever. "If you can say out loud that this stuff is killing you and yet you still go back to it, I don't wish that feeling on anyone." In Paris with her friend Randy, Lisa discovered what it was like to travel sober. When Randy assured her she wouldn't drink during their trip, Lisa was touched but conflicted. She didn't want to be a burden. She realized she was like a new vegetarian, unsure how to navigate social situations without making others uncomfortable. Unlike her previous Paris trip spent in a haze of wine, drugs, and hangovers, this time she actually saw the city. She woke early, enjoyed cafes, and felt profound gratitude. She even sought out an English-speaking 12-step meeting at the American Church. Getting lost on the way, her insecurities surfaced along with cravings for morning drinks, but she repeated her Gracie Square mantra, "Get up, get dressed, get with the program." She discovered a new perspective on gratitude, appreciating both what's good and what isn't bad, like not being face down in her own vomit. Back home, Lisa attended group twice weekly and 12-step meetings every other day. She chose Jennifer as her sponsor, a manufacturing executive whose sobriety journey mirrored hers. When Lisa planned dinner with drinking friends after just 3 months sober, Jennifer challenged her. "Have you ever, in 15 years with these people, not had a drink?" Lisa canceled, admitting she wasn't ready. Later, she faced her first post-rehab party at Jerry's 40th birthday. Jessica and Devin hovered protectively while wine flowed freely around her. She left early, sober and happy. At home, she played the tape through, imagining the disastrous outcomes had she drunk. The next morning, she enjoyed coffee in sunshine while others nursed hangovers. Though she felt like an outsider at the party, she later realized that night was the most extraordinary accomplishment of her life. 12 years into sobriety, Lisa reflected on her journey. She'd made amends to those she hurt, though not all had forgiven her. She'd maintained a career that would have been impossible while drinking, despite occasionally suffering anxiety attacks during presentations. She married a wonderful man in their Santa Fe home, wearing pale blue because white would have felt ridiculous. She was present for her father's death, administering his morphine and delivering his eulogy. She witnessed recovery friends achieve remarkable success and others relapse. She buried a best friend whose death she still couldn't accept. The recovery community sustained her. She called sober friends who helped her stay clean, and she helped others salvage their lives. She became a present aunt who showed up for sleepovers with her niece and nephew. Though many mornings she hadn't wanted to get out of bed, most mornings she did. For more than 4,000 mornings, she awakened and made the same decision. "Just for today, I will not drink."